This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. This is Pacific Beats on ABC Radio Australia, coming to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. Today on the show, a land dispute between Indonesia and Timorese farmers reaches boiling point. Meanwhile, calls grow for a treaty to ban the proliferation of fossil fuels. And the recovery continues for communities in Vanuatu, 12 months after the country was hit by two major cyclones. All that and more coming up. I'm Kyle Evans, filling in for Agitupo. Thank you for joining me. But first, in Tonga, there's no resolution in sight to the political standoff between the king and the government. It's been several weeks since King Tupu VI sent shockwaves through the kingdom with a letter from his Privy Council effectively withdrawing support for Prime Minister Siosi Sobaleni and his foreign minister. In Parliament, the nobles have demanded the monarch's wishes be obeyed, but so far, Mr. Sobaleni has resisted the pressure to resign, albeit tearfully, as Marian Kupu reports from Nukualofa.
On the streets of Nukualofa, feelings about the kingdom's political stalemate are mixed.
It's getting more into like every man for himself. It's no longer a coordinated effort for the betterment of the whole nation, I feel. And you kind of hear in the deliberations, like, it's fragmented, you know. They are there for themselves.
It looks like there's a division or not working together between government and people's representative in Tonga. And we can see this by the prolonged delay of the session of the parliament in recent months, while at the same time the people were struggling with the power crisis.
I still fully support Prime Minister Sovaleni and also the Minister of Foreign Affairs and Tourism because the Privy Council letter did not specify what was the reason of his withdrawal of his confidence.
It's now been almost a month since King Tupu VI Privy Council sent the now infamous letter withdrawing his support for the government, but we're no closer to a resolution. In Tonga's parliament late last week, noble representative Lord Duivakano made their position crystal clear.
The letter meant for both of you to resign. The king's letter stated his thoughts, but we, the nobles, are advising and asking you both to resign from the portfolios as the Minister of Defence, Minister of Foreign Affairs and Tourism.
Yet Prime Minister Sovaleni, although tearful, is standing firm.
I am truly sorry if my actions say otherwise. It's all my fault. But by all means, there is no intention to stand against the king. Chairman, we are trying. I'm asking the nobles to please let us try to work this with the palace office. But also know this. I not only speak my respect to His Majesty, I live it.
It is understood King Tupu VI is on Niue Island, an outer island of Tonga, and has been there for almost a month. It is unclear when he will return to Tonga. Meanwhile, there is confusion on the streets regarding who is right and who is wrong, with academics and political commentators in constant debate. They say the nobles have sided with the king as they are the awhiwhala or protector of the king. Yet some, like prominent Tongan writer, social commentator and youth worker Sia Uhila Angilau, just want more transparency.
Even like in terms of cabinet and His Majesty, I see it maybe, or maybe I'm just too simple, but I'm like, I think this could take 5 minutes if they got together and just sit down and talk. I mean, what is so complicated about that, you know?
It is the first time Tonga's parliament where a king has withdrawn his consent in the government in this way. Tongan custom states it is only right to abide by the king's request and concern, which the prime minister opposed. For Sia Uhila Angilau, not obeying every wish of the king is more reflective of a modern Tonga.
personally, for me, I feel like if we are moving into the direction of democracy, we have to, you know, the king also has to be accountable, you know, in what he is doing, you know. Like, for me as a common and ordinary person, when I hear that, like, when I hear that he says, oh, you need to be out, you know, I'm like, yeah, why? Yeah, I mean, you owe that to the people that you lead to explain those things, you know. You can't just say, oh, because that goes back into kind of a dictatorship. I feel like we have just slowly proceeded out of that era, you know.
There are four pillars of the Tongan culture: respect, humility, nurturing relationship, and loyalty. These pillars are the core values platform for families, community, and country to talk and discuss any issues. And now the people are waiting for their leaders to act with their pillars in mind.
Marion Kupu reporting there from Nuku'alofa. Well, in Timor-Leste, an old land dispute with its neighbour Indonesia is about to reach a climax. Timorese farmers in a remote area say a plan to move the border between the two countries will take away their land and their livelihoods. The ABC's Timor-Leste reporter Vonia Vieira travelled to the far western province of Akusi for this story.
Noviana Tome lives a simple life.
I go to field rice at 8 a.m. and back from there at 4 or 5 p.m.
Every year, she produces 50 sacks for her family, their main source of food. But these days, there is a problem.
I have so many rice fields. If we handed them all over to Indonesia, what would we do? We wouldn't be able to meet our needs and to feed our children. We depend on the rice fields.
Mr. Tome, land is on the northern tip of Akusi, known as Naktuka. The area is a special administrative zone, an enclave of Timor-Leste, surrounded by West Timor, a province of Indonesia. And this is part of the problem. A new border identified for the area is said to hand over 270 hectares of land, use it by more than 250 farmers to Indonesia.
We are just poor people. We are farmers. The rice fields are our rice fields.
Local farmer Domingo Falo says the farmers have been in the area for generations.
As far as I know, the border has been there for a long time.
The territorial boundary of the area dates back to the Portuguese colonial period, when that ended in 1975. Indonesia invaded, occupying Timor-Leste for 24 years before its 1999 independence referendum. After independence, Indonesia and Timor-Leste came to an agreement over most borders and territories. But small sections are still to be resolved. The northern tip of Akusi is one of those areas.
These rice fields are very large. They raise lots of buffalo. They are ordinary people who don't depend on the government. They can organize their lives to meet their daily needs.
That was Pedrito Vieira from Timor-Leste, land networking organization, an NGO representing the farmers. He says the government must be more transparent to local farmers about its dealings with Indonesia and why this is happening.
They must explain openly and honestly.
Timor-Leste Prime Minister Sanana Gusmao visited the area last month to speak with the local community. Although Indonesia media is reporting the new border area has been decided, Gusmao says otherwise.
I asked all of you twice here, and you said you could come. I also asked local leaders here and said you could come. Then we went to Indonesia and told them we can start discussing the land. We won't do it without consulting you. We won't do it without consulting our ancestors.
The proposed new border has been identified by both Timor-Leste and Indonesia and marked out with new pillars. It also follows a local river. Again, Timor-Leste Prime Minister says the talks are continuing.
We can convince them not this one, not this river, but we must consider their request. Do not drive away those who come to farm in this part.
The ABC contacted the Indonesia Embassy in Timor for comment. A month after Mr. Gusmao's visit, local farmers are still unsure what will happen to their land. For Nurviana Tome, it's simple.
We're asking the government to pay attention to us so that our land is not given to them, because it's our plate, our food and drink.
That report from Vonia Vieira. Well, governments across the Pacific have long fought for Australia to start phasing out fossil fuels. However, now Australia's opposition is preparing to detail plans to take a nuclear policy into the next election. It would overturn a decades-old ban on the industry and map out how nuclear might fit into Australia's energy mix. The party is confident the public will get on board and questions over cost and feasibility can be answered, but some energy experts have significant doubts. Here's political reporter Tom Lowry.
In some parts of the world, the push to nuclear is picking up pace.
Unlike other carbon-free sources, nuclear provides resilient, reliable energy.
This is a campaign produced by the US Department of Energy.
And a new generation of reactors will bring the benefits of clean, reliable nuclear power to more places than ever before.
The US was one of 22 countries to sign a pledge at last year's COP28 climate summit in Dubai to triple nuclear capacity globally by 2050. Australia wasn't one of them, and nuclear power has been banned in Australia since the late 1990s. The coalition is shaping up to try and change that. Here's Shadow Assistant Energy Minister, Holly Hughes.
This is a conversation worth having, but unfortunately we have a situation in Australia where it is fundamentally banned from even being able to have that discussion because of the EPBC Act. And we need to see that change.
The coalition is expected to detail its nuclear energy policy before the federal government's May budget. It will likely identify regions suited to the new industry, primarily those currently producing coal-fired power. Many in the coalition feel that public opinion has shifted on nuclear, and the policy appeals to younger voters. Senator Hughes says there's a solid case to make.
It's going to provide that affordable and reliable baseload power that can be at any time. So if the wind's not blowing and the sun's not shining, that power can still be generated without the need to build tens of thousands of kilometres of new transmission lines.
But many energy experts warn of plenty of hurdles for nuclear energy in Australia. Alison Reeve from the Grattan Institute says the only possible role nuclear might play is a small one.
There's simply no way that you could build it to help us with our immediate problems that we've got around coal exit. In the very long term, the issue for the energy market is how we manage the very last bit of converting away from fossil fuels. At the moment, it looks like the most economic opportunity for that is gas with offsets to cover the emissions.
And she says that's probably not appealing to potential investors.
The problem for the private sector is that they would be building an asset that doesn't get used very often, so the revenue from it would be very uncertain, and so it would be a very high-risk investment.
There are countries investing in nuclear energy, but many are facing problems doing so. The UK's first new plant in two decades has been plagued by delays and extraordinary cost blowouts. And one of the most promising developers of new small modular reactors, American firm NuScale, wound up its project late last year due to soaring costs. Tennant Reid from AI Group says nuclear is an option Australia should keep up its sleeve, but not pin any hopes on.
It's a sensible thing to do to add to the tools in the chest. It's maybe not a great idea to pin all of your hopes on one technology and go have a sit on the couch while waiting for that technology to show up. I don't know that anybody's suggesting that, but they shouldn't.
Tennant Reid from AI Group, ending that report from Tom Lowry.
Hi, I'm Sayuli Salamasinovan-Raiki, and I invite you to come with me to explore how our Pacific cultures have evolved with the changing times in a new show, Culture Compass. You'll meet people who are passionate about keeping traditions alive, passing them down to the next generation while adapting old ways to the present. Culture Compass, Tuesdays at 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
It is that time of the morning where we take a look at what's making headlines around the Pacific region. And to help me do that this morning, I'm joined by producer Mackenzie Smith. Mackenzie, how are you going this morning?
Doing good, Kyle. How are you?
I'm well, Mackenzie. Thank you. It's always good to be back in the chair after a few months off to see if you can remember how to do things. But look, let's start with a new report from the Ocean Foundation. They say deep sea mining is unlikely to be worth it. What have they found?
Yeah, so as we know, there have been long-standing environmental concerns about deep-sea mining, which is a prospective commercial industry that extracts nodules from the seafloor. These nodules are packed with manganese, copper, cobalt, and nickel, which can be used for technology like electric car batteries. So this new report from the Ocean Foundation says the budding industry ignores the fact that metal prices have not risen in line with electric vehicles, an industry that is likely to be moving away from cobalt and nickel to source its battery materials. The report says other factors, including international pressure to halt deep sea mining, are also likely to discourage investors.
Yeah, look, really interesting stuff. Now, the metals company is leading deep sea mining efforts in the Pacific as well. What have they said in response?
Yeah, so its chief executive, Gerard Barron, told RNZ the deep sea nodules contain several minerals, which reduces economic risks if one metal loses value. He says these minerals are also likely to be needed for future energy transitions that we don't know about now. Barron says the report is a desperate attempt to stop an inevitable process.
And just lastly, Mackenzie, we're going to go to Indonesia's West Papua, where thousands more police are set to hit the streets. What's this one about?
Yeah, so Compass reports that Indonesia's government is recruiting 10,000 police for deployment to West Papua over the next 4 years. Senior police officials say the move is necessary to maintain order across the sprawling region, but Papua Police Chief Matthias Fakiri says they will also help, the officers will also help improve the access of remote areas in Papua to essential services.
And apologies, one more story as well. We've got one in Papua New Guinea where an attempt to stop future motions of no confidence has made it to Parliament.
Yeah, this is the proposed amendment to the constitution that would introduce an 18-month grace period for a government that survives a no-confidence vote, drastically reducing the number of no-confidence motions that can be moved by the opposition. Currently, there are no restrictions on that. The Post Courier reports that the amendment has now gone before Parliament, but it will take around a year and need the support of two-thirds of Parliament to become law.
Yeah, that is an interesting one. I imagine the opposition would have a thing or two to say about it. Mackenzie, thank you so much for joining us on NewsWrap this morning.
No worries.
For centuries, Pacific Islanders have been sharing stories across the region. Stories from the Pacific is a weekly program that honours that tradition, allowing you to hear in-depth personal stories from sports people to farmers, artists to teachers, activists to entrepreneurs, with one thing in common: their Pacific heritage and a unique and incredible story to tell. Stories from the Pacific, Wednesday mornings at 9 o'clock PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Well, some communities in Vanuatu are still rebuilding a year after the country was pummeled by two major cyclones that struck just days apart. Cyclones Judy and Kevin, both Category 4 systems, tore through the country within 48 hours of each other, affecting around 80% of the population in some way. As if that wasn't bad enough, the recovery from the twin cyclones was set back when Category 5 Cyclone Lola swept through in October. The Save the Children's charity, Save the Children, says some people are still living in temporary shelters. It's also piloting a food preservation project to help people prepare for future disasters. And joining us to discuss how things are going is Save the Children's head of operations in Vanuatu, Relvi Matariki. Relvi, welcome to the program.
Hi, and good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, look, not a problem at all. I mean, look, as we just heard in the intro, Vanuatu went through so much over the last 12 months. What's the situation a year on from those cyclones?
So it's been a year since Cyclone Judy and Kevin that struck Vanuatu, so 80% of the country's population. So I remembered a widespread destruction that happened of the homes, especially the southern part of the country and the central, where the capital city is. I can recall during that time of the cyclone where we were sitting at the corridor, and then because of the strong wind, it hit down the door to our room. And I was 6 months pregnant at the time with two kids under the age of 9. So I think our kids are still being traumatized by it. And by that, I mean, like, we have like concrete homes, but it's also still impacting kids that are back in the communities because of their houses and all those. So slowly response has been completed. Like, we've done response already. People are slowly recovering at the moment. For example, the Tafia province that was hit by Judy Kevin and TC Judy Kevin, and also the Sheba province, the recovery is slowly. People are slowly recovering. The reason behind the slow recovery is because of the other situation that we have on now is the dry season. So people are slowly recovering and also facing the dry season, and also the material costing, the materials that are available in the rural areas. It's a bit difficult for people to get sea transportation, to be able to transport materials to their homes, to be able to rebuild. Not only the shelter part of it and people are slowly recovering, it's also the schools. Some schools have been greatly damaged are slowly putting small fixes. And while they're still recovering, we had the TC Lola back in October again. So children across Vanuatu are extremely resilient, but it's not enough time to be able to allow children and their families to fully recover.
Yeah, look, you talked about the timing a second ago of Judy and Kevin, just them hitting so closely together. It was almost unprecedented. You were obviously in Vanuatu at the time. What was it like knowing that you had two cyclones bearing down on you? Had that ever happened to you before in your memory?
Not that I can recall, not like three category five cyclone in a span of less than a year. So that has never happened before. I think we had Judy Kevin, and then 6 months after we had the TC Lola. I think one thing is the track that went down, how the TC Lola, I think while it's not fortunate to have two cyclones hitting at the same time, but I think the track at that time, we were very lucky that it didn't hit the Tafia province, the northern part of the country again, because the first two, it was the southern and the central part that really got really impacted. The second one that came in TC Lola, it was only at the northern part in the Panama province. So I would say, like, for us, it's while it's three cyclones in the same year, at least it did not pass in the same location where the twin cyclone hit us.
Yeah, and look, as we know, we are heading into the dry season. We're at the tail end of summer now. But what has this wet season been like in Vanuatu, knowing what happened in the last 12 months? Has there been an extra, I guess, sense of angst, you know, waking up every day?
We are, like still in, like people are still, because it's still the cyclone season, we are not like relaxing. Anything could happen anytime again. While we have little rain, it's pretty, it's getting really hot. For us that have access to water, we are not seeing that gap yet. Like really, it's just the hot weather. But people from the rural communities that don't have good access to water is definitely like they, you know, getting an additional burden added to them again, like slowly recovering, still trying to recover, because the restoration of their houses, all the natural resources to build the houses are all damaged as well. Not only to add on to that one is the social issues that come with it. Like the manpower that we have to build the communities are back in seasonal working to be able to find money, to be able to support their family. So in the communities, we only have the vulnerable communities, the mothers, the widows and the kids. So to build, and then the level of anxiety and, you know, the next cyclone can happen anytime now in March and in April. And with this hot weather, it's already like for us in instinct when it's that hot is we are expecting another cyclone, and it's becoming very, very hot. So probably a next cyclone is coming, but everyone is slowly recovering and at the same time preparing for the next.
And
if there's any.
And what sectors sustained, do you think the biggest losses? Was it businesses? Was it farms that were mainly affected?
It was business, especially because people rely mainly on farming as well. And so it's the food that people, you know, planned to be able to supply to their families, and also, excuse me, and also to make additional income to be able to sustain. So it's the house, I would say, food and security is the main one that people are most affected by it. Businesses, I would say, yes, and especially the DC Lola happened in the Panama province, but it's the businesses in the Tafia province and the Sheva province, where the capital city is, that are most affected as well during the twin cyclone, because of businesses have to close, damage and all those. But it will be food and security.
Yeah, I have seen firsthand what impact crazy weather can have on soil and sediment and crops and things like that. I mean, as we're heading into the dry season, which is typically a growing season for a lot of farmers, are they worried about what this year's yield could bring, given they probably sustained a lot of damages 12 months ago?
Yes, definitely everyone, especially the farmers, are worried because of this one, because they're not able to produce a big quantity of, you know, goods to sustain their family and also for their sale in the market. That pushed them also to increase costing of items and goods in the market. And then, you know, other people are consumers are complaining about it. So people are definitely worried. And I believe, well, I don't have the answer at the moment, but I believe the agriculture, the Ministry of Agriculture are supporting farmers, you know, how to be able to support them to be able to grow goods or their vegetables in times with the hot season, and, you know, being able to have enough to sustain them if the cyclone or any cyclone hits again during this period.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Kyle Evans and I'm chatting with the head of operations at Save the Children Vanuatu, Relvi Matariki. We are looking back at the twin cyclones which struck Vanuatu exactly 1 year ago. Now, Relvi, you obviously work for Save the Children, so let's talk about the children. What's the impact been like on them over the last 12 months?
Yeah, especially when we had the TC, I think for Judy Kevin, the social support that the children need now back in our communities, while this is definitely a need, it's not communicated at the community level. It's discussed among the family. So people are resilient. It's just not putting it out, you know, for others to see that we are weak and all those. It's affecting children, it's affecting families as well. But as I mentioned, it's not a topic that is being discussed widely in communities. probably small talks within families or only. So, and when we came through TC Lola, it was at around the time when we had examination. So it was really difficult, especially for children that had exams. All their classrooms, especially in Panama province, all the classrooms were damaged. We had to do temporary shelters, and kids who had to share classrooms. Some, like the school has started already in February 5th, but some schools have not started yet because their classroom was totally. So it's impacting children not being able to access education or that level in schools.
And what do those children in particular, but also those who are rebuilding, still need going forward in 2024 just to help everybody catch up?
So when so just in terms of children, they still need center around classrooms, and also with this dry season, it's more difficult for communities to recover fully. So I would say for children, classroom again for them to be able to go inside and continue schools. It's also material. In the central part, the capital city, we have access to ship and all those and materials. It's the schools outside. While they may have some fundings to be able to get materials, the shipping transportation is not accessible like on a weekly basis. It's probably after a month or so. So they have to fly in to get the materials and then find a way back again. So the materials is also another a need for people back in the communities. And to be able to access these materials, transportation is also another issue. And that dry season in particular, especially the Panama province where we have by water, is not that water is sometimes an issue, especially when we have after cyclones. So the water systems and being able to have enough water to sustain, especially boarding schools, is definitely a need.
I'm curious to know, because this has been an issue elsewhere in the Pacific, but did the number of seasonal workers that Vanuatu had working overseas, did that impede the rebuild, just given that there wasn't a lot of manpower on the ground to build everything back up?
Yes, so seasonal working families find other ways to, while we it can be seen as a benefit to the families to be able to get money to support. So yes, they get enough money to provide back to their families. It's just the human resource on ground. We may have relatives on ground to be able to support, but it's slowly, because it's just the mothers or the caregivers, like the grandmothers, who are looking after the kids. So slowly, it's not that like before where we have manpower on ground to be able to speed up and all those. It's holding hands together with other community members to be able to support. Okay, let's build or support this family first and then move to the other. So it's joint effort for everybody.
Now, we spoke about the farmers and the fears they have earlier as we head into dry season. I guess that's where I want to cap things off, because I understand that you are involved in a food preservation project. So what's involved with that?
Right. So so with the food preservation, it's a different project, but they have the same aim of working in the communities within Vanuatu. So it's to help to adapt to the impact of climate crisis. So this project is about $47 million, and it's delivered with the Green Climate Fund, and it's being implemented, and it's the largest ever investment in community-based climate change adaptation in the Pacific region. So we are supporting local-led adaptation to increase their food security, so and building their climate resilient by restoring and protecting coastal areas, and also helping women-led enterprises in climate resilient agriculture and fisheries techniques, how to preserve the food. So currently with the Green Climate Fund project, they're reaching more than 90,000 people, or probably say a half of the country's population across the six provinces.
Yeah, it sounds fantastic. And when might we see the impacts of that project start to yield fruit?
In terms of the project, so we are at the first stage of the pilot. They've preserved some foods already, and they're scaling up just to see where have. So they've partnered with some other partners in country as well, how to be able to preserve food. Yes, I don't have the answer with me at the moment, but definitely it's still in process, the pilot, and they're still finding ways of the lessons learned and how to be able to scale up to be able to see what are the foods again we'll be able to preserve, and what are the things we need to, you know, have in place in order for the foods to be preserved ready for the next cyclone.
Oh, well, look, it's great to hear that there are such good initiatives in the works regardless, and we'll definitely keep our eye on to see how that project takes shape. Relvi, that's all we've got time for today on Pacific Beat, but thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, and thank you for having me. Have a nice day.
Not a problem. You too. That was the head of operations at Save the Children, Vanuatu, Relvi Matariki. We were discussing the ongoing impact that those twin cyclones are continuing to have 12 months after they struck Vanuatu.
Join me, Melissa Macon, for Nija Daily, the afternoon edition, every Tuesday and Wednesday on ABC Radio Australia. I'll bring you the stories of the week from across the Pacific and talk health and religion with experts in their field and individuals making a difference. Nija Daily, the afternoon edition, every Tuesday and Wednesday from 4 o'clock PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Well, Vanuatu recently reported its first case of the army fallworm, with biosecurity officials rushing to contain the spread of the infectious pest. But here in Australia, farmers are describing its impact as identical to a bushfire. Brandon Long has the story.
Our area was hit pretty heavily with bushfires this season. A lot of the farmers are describing this identical to a bushfire. They're losing entire crops and complete losses on inputs, and there's no government subsidy or support for these farmers who basically lost everything.
That's Queensland grower Cameron Rackerman. Experts say the invasive insect, which originated in the Americas and reached Australia in 2020, is being detected at unprecedented levels in grain crops across Queensland and New South Wales. The 2023-24 summer sorghum crop, worth an estimated $1.5 billion, has been most affected, but other crops are also being targeted. Mr. Rackerman, who farms at Colston Lakes, 120 kilometres southwest of Bundaberg, and is chair of Colston Lakes Development Group, says it is the worst incursion they have experienced.
It's definitely our worst year to date. Nothing even comes close to the level of pressure we've had this year. So far, I reckon our little valley's probably suffered $1 million in lost production, and our chemical expenditure's up about 300%.
He says the main insecticide used to control the pest costs $1,000 a litre, making control very expensive. On his farm, 40 hectares of white French millet destined for the birdseed market was destroyed, costing him tens of thousands of dollars in losses. Nearby, Terry Stabe first noticed the caterpillars in his 60-hectare sorghum crop on Australia Day. A few days later, three-quarters of it was gone. Queensland Department of Agriculture and Fisheries principal entomologist Dr. Melina Miles says it is the most damaging season since 2020.
This year it's very widespread. You know, every sorghum and maize growing region in Queensland, from the Atherton through the Burdekin, down into central Queensland, through the Burnett, the Darling Downs, and then into northern New South Wales. I've had reports from all of these regions with quite severe infestations for the most part.
Dr. Miles says the increase in pest numbers can be attributed to a later than usual sorghum planting due to the late rain, pushing the plants into a period of higher fall armyworm activity. She says it is also possible that the weather systems associated with the recent cyclones has facilitated the movement of large fall armyworm populations into central Queensland. Dr. Miles is urging growers to be alert but not alarmed, and take a considered approach to making decisions about the need for control. With some growers questioning if DAF has done enough to control the pest, Dr. Miles says they were in the early stages of developing robust management recommendations and research was ongoing.
It's important to remember that the other key pests we have, things like Helica verpa and so on, we've had 50 years of research on those. Lots of work to be done, but we're certainly in a much better position in terms of growers having management strategies to put in place now than we were in 2020. To some extent, I'm optimistic that what we're seeing is not the start of what fall armyworm pressure will be like going forward, but an outbreak year where it's been an early start to the season, so we've managed to fit in a couple more generations. That always means that the population builds up to a higher level and you get much higher activity by this time of year towards the end of the season.
Entomologist Dr. Melina Miles speaking there. Well, for the first time, a private company has successfully landed a spacecraft on the moon. The vessel, called Odysseus, will spend the next 7 days there conducting experiments. Here's Elizabeth Cramsey.
The Odysseus lander is 4 metres tall, 1.5 metres wide, and standing on 6 legs. It will spend the next 7 days gathering data on the challenges spacecraft face when landing on the moon. One of the elements posing the biggest risks for missions is moon dust. Associate Professor Alice Gorman is a space archaeologist at Flinders University.
The dust was really sticky. It was electrostatically charged, just like when, you know, you rub a balloon against a woolen jumper. So the dust is charged, it sticks to everything. It's really sharp and abrasive. It has razor-sharp, tiny, tiny particles all through it. There's never been any water on the moon to sort of soften those edges out like beach sand.
Since the Apollo missions in the 1960s, concerns have been raised over those tiny particles.
And even on the couple of hours the Apollo 11 astronauts were on the moon, they started to notice that it could potentially do things like wear away at the seals on their suits, which would breach them and make them breathe in lunar nothingness, and that it clogged up equipment, made things difficult to operate, and it made visibility very low. The astronauts on all 6 Apollo missions also observed how landing and taking off blew this dust over quite long distances. So we know that the dust is going to get everywhere, stick to things, and potentially stop equipment from working.
And there are a few experiments on Odysseus to see how that could be managed.
One was it had cameras attached to its legs so it could get images of what was happening with the dust in that process of descending and actually landing. So this is really critical information we haven't had. And the Eagle camera, which was a student-run, student-created experiment, also had procedure for trying to repel the dust. So the dust is charged, so if you use an opposite charge, you can potentially make it not stick. You can make it vanish. It literally won't stick because it's the wrong charge. So they had a little experiment to see if you could stop the dust from sticking.
Dr. Brad Tucker is an astronomer at the Australian National University. He says today's moon landing is an exciting development.
It's a new way of going about business in space. We've seen how private companies have allowed quicker, cheaper access into space around the Earth. What used to cost tens of thousands of dollars per kilogram to take to the International Space Station now only costs $1,000 to $2,000. And with so many more groups going, we can send more experiments and do more science. And now this is the new view of what we can do with the moon. Instead of waiting for a few national agencies to send a mission or people, you can send multiple of these landers and probes, getting more experiments and opening up all the science that we can do on the moon.
Dr. Brad Tucker from the ANU, ending that report from Elizabeth Cramsey. And that does bring us to the end of Pacific Beat. Time to take a look at our main story from today. On the streets of Tonga's capital, Nuku'alofa, the political standoff between the king and the government is causing confusion and debate.
Maybe I'm just too simple, but I'm like, I think this could take 5 minutes if they got together and just sit down and talk. I mean, what is so complicated about that, you know?
I'll be back at the same time tomorrow. That's 6 a.m. PNG time. I'm Kyle Evans, filling in for Aggie Tupou. Thanks for joining me.